sure.
I know. So we may just vote and have Patty do all the Zoom pledges from here on. Thank you, Assemblymember Gilbert. That was awesome. There's no ceremonial matters tonight. Roll call, please, Kim.
Sure. Assembly members Morrison?
Here.
DeLong? Decker?
Here.
Howell?
Here.
Gilbert?
Here.
And Mayor Prasanka?
Here. Persons to be heard. We have a few folks tonight that we're going to have under persons to be heard. And I'm just going to bring up my list here. We've made a special request for two folks. Is Jamie Parker on the line right now?
She's connecting right now.
Okay, excellent. And I'll just quickly introduce Jamie while she's connecting. Jamie is the lab manager for the virology unit at the Alaska State Public Health Laboratory, and it's located at the University of Alaska campus in Fairbanks, Alaska, and it provides a statewide viral diagnostic services that aid in the diagnosis and surveillance of human viral disease that are of public health importance. So I still see Jamie's trying to connect here, so we'll give her a second. We've asked both Jamie and Erin Michaels, our community health nurse, to be on the line tonight to talk a little bit about some of the issues and questions that we have, and I'm sure the community has as well. Jamie, are you on the line? Kim, is it possible for you to unmute Jamie's?
There we go.
There, is that better?
Can you hear me? Hi, Jamie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, thank you so much. I just did a quick introduction and you may not have heard it. I introduced that you were the lab manager for the virology and that went through a little bit about what it's about, but would you maybe do a little more introduction for us so everybody knows where you work and what you do and the importance of your work?
Sure. Absolutely. So I am Jamie Parker. I'm the laboratory manager for the Alaska State Virology Lab in Fairbanks. We are doing about half of the testing for public health labs. There is another lab in Anchorage that is assisting us with this outbreak. Our goal here is to test patients who are symptomatic, who are travelers into Alaska, who are coming in to work at our fisheries, our canneries. We test anywhere between 300 and 1,000 specimens per day. We are constantly trying to find ways to gain capacity and to improve our testing services and our ability to get those results out to you as fast as possible so that the epidemiologists can do their work and respond to any positive cases or positive cases that even come from other testing platforms that we try to confirm here at this laboratory. We also do a weekly report, and it's online, and if you'd like to join it, you just have to click on the subscribe button for it. It basically goes through all the testing we do here, not just COVID-related, but HIV, influenza, and other things that we test for here, and we show that we're doing some whole genome sequencing of the viruses that we are collecting from around Alaska, which shows that we've got about four different genetic clades of the virus circulating, five genetic lineages. So we just want to make sure that the diagnostic systems that we have in place across Alaska and the ones that we use here are capable of capturing all those different types of viruses. And so far, so good. We've been able to pick up all these different viral particle types by the assays that we're using. The ones that we use here at the Public Health Lab are designed by the Centers for Disease Control. And they have about 99% sensitivity with 100% specificity. So we do like to help confirm any cases that are suspect as being false negative for the most part. We don't do a whole lot of work with false positivity, but there are a few other things that we can do here. We don't have it validated in a reportable way, but we have the assays that other countries are using. In Denmark, in China, in Germany, Thailand, just quite a few different primer sets that are being used across the planet. And if we aren't able to pick up something with the CDC assay that was positive on other platforms, sometimes we can try other things to identify that virus in that specimen. So I guess who I am is I manage a group of virology professionals, and this is our bag here. This is what we do here. And so I would say we are the your experts in the state of Alaska. Is that good enough?
Sorry to go on and on. Well done.
Great.
You know, Jamie, one of the questions that I know we're getting a lot about is that if, and I don't, of course, appreciate that we are not speaking necessarily about any specific patient and are just speaking about generally here. And we don't, of course, ever want to be thought of divulging any specific information. But generally, can you tell us that if somebody was to test positive, what is the normal protocol? What happens next? What is there follow-up tests? What's the normal protocol on your end?
So on our end, just being a laboratorian, I think there's going to be an epidemiologist here to help answer what they do on their end. But for us, when we detect a positive, that is an actionable event. We definitely call the provider that patient came from, so usually the hospital or clinic that took that specimen. We also report that to the Department of Epidemiology immediately so that they can begin calling that patient and asking who they've been around, I think, for the last 14 days, which can be really hard. I don't know if any of you can think back of who you've been around the last 14 days. I know that Dr. Zink has said if you can't remember who you've been around in the last 10 days, you've probably been around too many people. So I think for us, any positive that we see at this laboratory, we're taking very seriously and trying to isolate that patient and anyone else who's been in contact just to remove any potential possibility for this thing to spread and to become somewhat out of control in different parts of the state.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have any specific questions for Jamie? And Jamie, I apologize if you're a doctor and I'm not addressing you correctly, but.
No. That's okay. Totally fine. I actually just completed a doctorate at UAF. Last month, I went to my Zoom ceremony, and I'm the title, so don't even worry about it.
Well, Dr. Parker, you deserve to be called Dr. Parker then. Congratulations. I see Assemblymember Gilbert, you have a question.
Dr. Parker, I just had a few calls a couple of hours ago from community members, and they wanted to know about the percentage of false positives, and you may have answered that in your introductory statement, but also I had a question about viral load. Can your test determine the degree of viral load on a patient?
Yeah, I'll try that first one about false positivity. That isn't something that we've really been focused on here in the state or across the country, or even literature that I was looking for this morning about this topic. There just really isn't anything published about the rates of false positivity. We certainly haven't seen that here. The positives that have come to me from Cepheids or Abbott's or different platforms that I have not been able to recover has usually been subpar specimen collection on the part that the specimen I got wasn't really great, and so I wouldn't really trust that negative versus a positive. Most of these positives make sense in terms of the person did maybe travel outside, or there's been situations where just the epidemiological data makes sense for that positive. So we really haven't dove very deep into the false positivity aspect of some of these tests. We're basically acting on all of them and making sure that we're protecting communities. Now, the part that I'm more concerned about is the false negativity rates that's been widely published. Some of these quickie tests have kind of a high false negativity rate, which means somebody could be told they're negative, but really they are positive and able to have this false sense of security sort of in the community where they're spreading disease unknowingly. So that's what I'm concerned with. And if a patient is testing negative, but they've got all the signs and symptoms of COVID, then I like to get those specimens and do a little bit more work with those. So hopefully that answers that first part. The second part about viral load, yes, our test can give some indication of the viral titer in that specimen. We have a little bit more diagnostic ability to determine high positives, low positives, and specimens that test negative on some platforms, we have the ability to find positives in those specimens just because our level of sensitivity, or what is called our limits of detection, are a little bit better with that CDC assay. But as we're finding, most of the confirmations that we test confirm, there's very few discordant results. And like I said, there's just so few that we really look at those specimens as, I'm testing basically the dredges of what the clinical labs tested initially. So I'm kind of just today trying to wrap my head around maybe asking for another specimen collection that is CDC approved, instead of trying to, you know, get positives from the dregs of specimens that have already been tested. So yes, I can kind of tell you what the viral load is, and definitely these tests are dependent on picking up enough virus in order to be positive. So that's a great question, and definitely the sampling time and collection matters. If you sample someone a little too early in the quarantine time, you might miss it. If you, so there is a good collection window, I think, but everybody's going to be different depending on where they've been and their situation.
Thank you. Assemblymember Gilbert, did you have a follow-up at all there?
No, that answered the questions that community members asked me. That was perfect.
Yeah, very good answer. Thank you. Other folks with questions for Dr. Parker? I'm going to jump in with a second one, Dr. Parker. So we saw several incidents in Sitka where somebody initially tested positive and then there was a negative test. And to be honest with you, I lost track where it went after that. I guess I assumed that if the second test was negative, there'd be a third, or is it that if somebody is positive, they remain positive? How does that process work? Because there seems to be a process for basically validating the test.
Right. So a patient, we've had quite a few of these situations where patients will test positive, and then we sort of track them throughout their disease progression. And what we're detecting is the RNA of the virus. So if the virus is there, if the nucleic acid is there in the nasopharynx, we will find it. Sometimes at the end of these respiratory diseases, there is what I'm calling, I don't know if other people call it, but viral litter sort of hanging out in the nasopharynx. This could be RNA that's not infectious. It could be degraded RNA just from the ends of an infection. But we're going to pick that up as a positive intermittently at the end of someone's infection. So sometimes we get a positive, next day could be a negative, third day could be inconclusive where we're only getting maybe half of the gene targets to amplify. The next day could be negative, and this can be very frustrating for somebody who wants to get back to life, wants to get back to work, but they can't seem to get a negative result consecutively, maybe two or three. I know in the healthcare settings, I think they want at least two negative consecutive test results before they'll let them come back. And this can be really frustrating. And I think depending on if you're using different testing platforms and you're trying different swabs and medias, you can have this sort of intermittent positivity at the end of infection. That's been my experience with a handful of patients we've been trying to help out since the beginning of this thing in March. So if you have people who are kind of in that boat, that's a really trying time for us diagnostically. And then it's also just difficult to understand if that positivity really means infectiousness and contagion. So we're not quite sure about that. As we learn more about the disease and how long people can transmit the virus, we'll know more about that in the months to come, I believe.
Thank you. That was excellent. Other questions? I'm going to break with a little bit of tradition here. I'd like to offer up to Captain Spray or Jamie Roberts If either of you, because you're so intimately involved in all this, if either of you have any questions, I'd hate for you to miss your opportunity to ask Dr. Parker a question. They're not moving.
No. Oh, wait.
there you are. Go ahead, Dorianne.
We had gone back and forth earlier, and I'll go ahead. Jamie put together a number of questions that I think are really good. So go ahead, Jamie.
Let me bring them up. So we went over the concept of the false positive. So the second question is, how can a person be asymptomatic and still test positive? And I think maybe you've perhaps covered that pretty well.
I could just say one more quick thing about that. Viruses can be very tricky. I know in other virus families, this idea of being asymptomatically infected is a way viruses can persist. This is the way they can make it through the host without being recognized, and they can still replicate and transmit. Some don't cause disease in some patients. So when this virus began its plight of asymptomatic carriers or asymptomatic patients, that's a true sign of viral persistence in that new host. So we expect this virus, because of its ability to be in asymptomatic patients, to stick around for quite a while.
Thank you. The next one is, can you explain the incubation period and how it relates to the testing? For example, when would a viral load be highest and when would a person be most contagious?
Yeah, I got to pull up my little chart here that I used. There was a nice one published recently that kind of showed that PCR is most likely to be positive within the first 3 weeks of your infection. After that, you might see some negativity, or what I was calling that intermittent kind of positive, negative happening at the end. But you can, let's see, the virus isolated nasopharynx. The nasopharynx can be infected and transmitting virus before symptom onset, but we don't know. A lot of people aren't getting tested in that range. So we do know within the first 3 weeks of your infection, that is the best time to get a positive result. About the incubation period, the average, I think average incubation period, I think they calculated this in a study from China, was about 5 days. And that's defined as when you were exposed to when you felt those first symptoms. So on average 5 days, but you know, it can go out to 11 or 12 days in some patients. And I think that's why we've been very conservative about the 14-day quarantine.
Thank you. And the last one is that we've been getting calls from individuals who are asymptomatic and they're requesting to be tested. Is that recommended? And if they get a test and it's negative, does that mean they can skip their 14-day quarantine?
I think I have to look at the mandate here, but I think what it says is if you want to self-quarantine for 14 days, there's no requirement for testing. If you do want to kind of get around that quarantine, you can get one of our molecular-based tests here in Alaska. And if it's negative, you have to kind of self-quarantine while you're waiting for those test results. And I will say we're getting a lot of airport specimens. Some are, you know, it takes us 2 or 3 days to get to them. So they still have to quarantine a little bit. And then you get a voucher for a second test. If you're negative, you get a voucher that you have to get a second test within that 7 to 14-day window, just to make sure that you haven't been incubating and that we didn't miss it on that first test. So I think that's how they've designed this mandate. Yeah.
Well, and really outside of the mandate, and Dr. Zink put together a really nice graphic today. I can't wait for her to share it, that makes it a little bit more clear for travelers. But I guess what I'm talking about is after a known positive case in the community, and if there's people that felt that maybe they were around the individual, but yet not deemed a close contact according to public health, and they want to go get tested, what's the recommendation for them? And maybe that's a Aaron Michael's question.
Yeah, I think Aaron would be better to answer that question if she's on the line.
Mr. Yeah. Mayor, thank you for the opportunity to ask questions.
You bet, Jamie. Erin, I'm going to get you to hold on answering that one, and we're going to, because you're going to, you'll be on the hot seat here soon enough. And we will open it up to anyone else who would like to ask a question from the assembly or staff. All right, Dr. Parker, I just want to thank you so much for being available to us tonight and taking the time to call in. As you know, we've had our first case, and so we've been truly fortunate to not have this come to the community, but we feel that we've had a chance to learn a bit and respond in a measured way, and this is just excellent information for everyone. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime, you guys. If you have questions, you can always call the lab and ask us. Thanks.
I think you may be hearing from two people that I know. So
yeah, no problem.
Thanks so much, Dr. Parker.
No problem.
Okay. Pastor Haggard, I've kept you, I let Dr. Parker go first here. Normally we open up with an invocation. I hope you don't mind. I apologize. I've made you sit through the COVID stuff. I would like to now call on you, please, to do an invocation for the assembly.
Hey, thanks so much. And I enjoyed listening. My computer was messed up, had to change devices. So it worked out perfect. Thank you.
Great.
Let's pray. God, I thank you for our leaders and for all that they do in our community. Lord, I ask you that you would just be with them tonight, Father, and not only tonight, but in the days ahead. God, that you would just continue to give them wisdom, guidance, and direction. Because, God, we need supernatural help. Because, Father, so many times we don't understand, but we know that you know all things. I ask that you would just bless their families, bless our community. God, just continue to work in each and every life. God, that you would just give help to each and every person. God, we thank you that we can turn to you. And Father, you not only hear, but you answer our prayers. It's in your precious Son, Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much, Kim. I really appreciate you coming out and doing the invocation for us. Feel free to stick around if you want. Otherwise, I completely understand if you're going to beg off. And
well, I have another Zoom meeting that I get set up, but I will probably add in probably not as me. So I can't use my count twice at the same
there
time.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Kim. Okay. Have a good evening. Bye.
Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye. Now. The next person under persons to be heard, many people in our community already know Erin Michaels. She is our community health nurse. She's actually based out of Petersburg, but she covers not only our community, but the community of Petersburg and Cake as well. And Erin has been working closely with us, sitting in on our joint EOC meetings, our joint command meetings on Wednesdays, and has been available to us the whole time through here, including Sunday, which I really appreciated. And we've asked Erin to come tonight and basically let the community know about what's happening and where things are going and where we're at right now with this first case. Erin?
So I had gotten the request, and I really appreciate you all inviting me to come to the assembly meeting. It's a big honor, and I always appreciate working with local public officials. So thank you very much for that. And I just kind of wanted to describe to the community and to the assembly what the process is like as far as from when somebody tests positive to when they're released. So with the positive case, Dr. Parker did mention that they notify the medical provider. Sometimes the medical provider wants to be the one to notify the patient that they had a positive case, and sometimes they decide that they would prefer that a public health official contact them. Almost all the cases that I've dealt with have been the medical provider notifying the patient initially. And then the state lab will also notify the section of epidemiology. The section of epidemiology then notifies public health nursing, and it gets assigned to the community public health nurse that is for that particular community. If it's after hours or weekends, then it would be an on-call public health nurse that still does these cases all across the state, because they do eventually let us have time off after hours and sometimes weekends. So in most cases, if it's Monday through Friday, then I am the person that is calling and doing the initial interview with the person that had a positive. And this interview is very intensive. It can take several hours. And we're looking at what the person was doing and who they were around. So we look back at who they were around 2 days prior to their symptoms starting, or if the case may be that they never had symptoms and they were just getting routine testing, then we look at the people they were around 2 days before they got a positive test. And then those are the people that, if they were within 6 feet of that person for more than 10 minutes, or if the person that was a positive coughed or sneezed on that person, or if they were identified as a high risk client, then the nurse will outreach those people. They are named as close contacts, and they'll do an additional interview with those people. So that process, just like I said, takes quite an extensive time. And then we also go back 14 days prior to the person either having symptoms or being tested and ask them, where were you in the last 14 days? Because we want to know where they might have caught it. And sometimes we can figure that out and sometimes we can't. Sometimes there we go and we see, oh, this person traveled from, New York City and, during that highly infectious time period where they had lots of cases, this probably is where they got it. But sometimes we can't identify that. We just don't know where they've gotten it. So there's different types. They kind of classify them as different types. There's travel associated. There is contact associated, meaning maybe they're a contact to another positive, and then they got sick, and now they become the index case, the positive case. And then there's community or unknown, which means we don't know where they got the infection from. I'm not necessarily the one that makes that decision. Sometimes Epi is the one that makes that. If we can see a clear picture of what happened, then it's simpler. But sometimes we don't have an easy answer as far as how a person got the infection. After we finish the initial interview with that positive case or that index case, then we go and contact all those people that were identified as people that were within, like I said, that 6 foot distance for greater than 10 minutes or coughed or sneezed on or high risk. And then we do a briefer interview with them. We're asking them, are you having signs or symptoms? Do you have a thermometer? Do you have mask? And we advise them that they need to quarantine for the next 14 days. From the last time they were around the person that had a positive case. And so, and we'll tell them, we'll be like, we see that your last day was this day for a contact with the positive case. So it's 14 days from that. And then we check in with the index case, which is the positive case, and the close contacts for 14 days, just to make sure each day that they are not having signs or symptoms. And if they are having signs or symptoms, then we're referring them to talk to their doctor. They may or may not need additional care. For the contacts, these are the people that are not the positive case, but have had contact with the positive case. If they're having signs or symptoms, we may recommend that they call their provider and see about getting testing. It's not required that people get testing that are contacts, but if they are having signs or symptoms, it's highly recommended. And then when all of that gets done, then we send the paperwork and the referral logs, if we're tracking all of this, to the section of epidemiology. They take this information, enter it into a form, and send it off to the CDC, and then the case is considered closed. You guys have any questions about that process?
Questions for Erin? And I'm just open it up to any question. And Jamie, I'm afraid I've forgotten the question that we were going to get back to. Do you want to re-ask that one? Jamie Roberts.
I'm trying to think of which one that is. I was thinking some of them would get passed on to Epi, but let me look in my list.
I think it has something to do with asymptomatic testing and getting done with quarantine earlier. I think that was the one that you guys, I wrote, that's what I wrote down in my little notes.
Yeah, so if we have people that are requesting, if we have people that are requesting to be tested, but they're asymptomatic, is that recommended? And if they were to be tested and received a negative test, does that mean they don't have to do their 14-day quarantine for those contacts? Or people that think they might have been a contact?
So I've heard Dr. Zink say over and over again, a testing doesn't mean that you can get out of jail free and you don't have to quarantine. As far as if you think that you've had contact, but if you haven't been called and you're asymptomatic, I would discuss that with your provider. And that is going to have to do with the capacity of the provider. So they may have enough tests that they could do testing for people that are asymptomatic. I don't know that that means that you can't not quarantine. I think quarantine, just because, and this is true for anyone that gets a test, you could test negative and a couple of hours later be positive. It just depends on that viral load component. And so the quarantine really is the safest measure we have right now to help stop the spread of the infection in a community. So I don't think that that would work as far as getting out of quarantine early. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thanks, Erin. Any other questions for Erin? Looks like you're getting off easy, Erin. You're in town right now, Erin. Do you want to just let folks know what you're doing while you're here? So I don't know if you have a public message or anything.
I was able to restart coming in. I typically do come at least once a month and provide services in the community. So that can include things like immunizations or WIC screens or TB screens or a variety of different things, STD screening. I also typically attend, when we were having them in person, the Healthy Wrangell Coalition meeting or any other meetings that are community focused on health that I can attend while I'm here. So I'm seeing clients tomorrow. I will also be part of several meetings here in Wrangell via Zoom and also via Petersburg in Zoom. So it's quite busy, but if you do have any questions, you can certainly give me a call while I'm here. I'll give you guys my number. It's 874-3615. I would encourage you to use that number while